Numbers, chapters 17, 18, and 19. The 10th talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on April 14, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 10, Numbers 17, 18, and 19, accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at Numbers chapter 17, 18, and 19 today. Remember that the issue that it's being dealt with in this center section of Numbers is, who has God given authority? Who has God designated as his representatives in their midst to provide leadership for the Israelites? And there are several challenges that have come to Moses all throughout. But here, it really is a challenge to both of them, but it's a little bit more focused on challenges to Aaron and his position as the priest. And we saw last week Korah's rebellion was a challenge to Aaron's position as priest. And then the very next day after Korah is killed, Korah and his followers are all swallowed up by the earth, there is murmuring, people are upset, and again it's a challenge to Moses and Aaron. And then we'll see in chapter 17, there isn't a challenge, but God sets up a test to demonstrate who it is that he has designated to be their leader. Then chapters 18 and 19 are a list of laws. And I think that those laws are all given in this context because they are significant with respect to what has just happened. Something that has always been missed on me when I've looked at Numbers in the past is that the Korah rebellion was a significant rebellion. And you can see that by the number of people that are involved, that are killed on that first event, and then in the plague that follows it that God sends, there are thousands of people that are killed in that. And all of that suggests that this is a widespread rebellion that's taking place. And it is stunning, really, that after Korah and Abiram and Dathan are swallowed up by the earth, and the 250 are consumed by fire that comes out from the temple, the very next day, people are blaming Moses and Aaron for the deaths of those leaders. It's quite amazing. But they still seem to think that Korah and those leaders were the holy ones. They were the ones that were, they were in the right. And so God sets up another test to hammer home the understanding that it is Aaron who was selected as to be the priest of the Israelites and to be their spiritual leader. Chapter 17, I'll start with the first section. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, and get from them a rod for each father's household, 12 rods from all their leaders according to their father's households. You shall write each name on his rod, and write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi, for there is one rod for the head of each of their father's households. You shall then deposit them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony where I meet with you. And it will come about that the rod of the man whom I choose will sprout. Thus I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel, who are grumbling against you. Moses therefore spoke to the sons of Israel, and all their leaders gave him a rod apiece for each leader according to their father's households, 12 rods, with the rod of Aaron among their rods. So Moses deposited the rods before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. So it's a relatively simple test as far as the setup is very simple. He's asking for the leader of each tribe to present their staff. And that staff signifies the power that's invested in that leader. That's kind of the sign of their power. They're supposed to bring each of their staffs, and Moses is supposed to place all of them in front of the Ark of the Covenant inside the tabernacle. It says in the place where God would meet with Moses. And they leave them there, and whichever one sprouts, then that's the one that is the leader, the spiritual leader of Israel. It says something that's oddly worded in here in verse 5. Thus I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel who are grumbling against you. And that's you plural in the Hebrew. So it's Aaron and Moses. It's an awkwardly phrased statement. And this is pretty literal. I shall lessen from upon myself the grumblings of the sons of Israel. It sounds to me rather naive on God's part at this point in the book of Numbers to think that this is going to change things, but that's what he says. And the grumblings against you. And we'll see a similar statement later on. So Moses does what he's told to do. He puts the rods in front of the Ark of the Covenant, and then we'll see what happens. Verse 8. Now it came about on the next day that Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the rod of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Moses then brought out all the rods from the presence of the Lord to all the sons of Israel. And they looked, and each man took his rod. But the Lord said to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony, to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumbling against me, so that they should not die. Thus Moses did just as the Lord had commanded him. So he did. So they're looking at all the staffs, all the rods that have been laid out there, and one of them, the staff that belongs to Aaron, has sprouted. It's got leaves, it's got buds, it's got almonds. That's amazing. That doesn't happen very often. And I'm not sure why it was an almond. The almond is one of the first ones that blooms in the spring and comes on in the spring. And the word for almond is the same word for watchful. And that's that play on words is used in Jeremiah. But I'm not sure how that plays in here. I suspect it does, but I just don't know how it plays in here. So everybody can see it. Everybody can see what had happened. There's one staff that buds and produces almonds. None of the others do. So everybody sees that, and then God tells Moses to put that staff back in by the Ark of the Testimony as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me. This is very curious. I don't know why. Why would you put the staff in the tabernacle where only the priests can go, rather than having it out where everybody can see it? But that's what God said to do. Presumably then, as time passes, the only way you know that it's there is by the testimony of the priests who would see it, which I think is very interesting. There is so much with respect to Judaism and Christianity where we have to accept the testimony, the witness of those who saw it. Whether it's the Gospels, whether it's Exodus, we have to accept the testimony. And we can question whether the testimony is sound or not, but if we determine that this testimony is sound, we have to take it on faith that that they have accurately presented what has happened. Okay. Next section, 12. Then the sons of Israel spoke to Moses, saying, "Behold, we perish, we are dying, we are all dying. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely?" Apparently, they are overwhelmed by this particular show of, I guess, God's power, and are afraid that they will die. Now, my suspicion is that there's more to it than that, and I'm going to develop this later as we go through, but my suspicion is that in Korah's rebellion, he had said, "We are all holy." And I think Korah was pushing a theology in which there was spiritual equality throughout, and therefore everybody could have access to God. Everybody was a priest. And here in this show, this demonstration, God is saying, "Aaron is your priest. No one else is." And there, if that's true, then they no longer have direct access to God. And I think that's what they're concerned about. But I'll develop that more later as we go on. Chapter 18. So the Lord said to Aaron, "You and your sons and your father's household with you shall bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear the guilt in connection with your priesthood. But bring with you also your brothers, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may be joined with you and serve you, while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony. And they shall thus attend to your obligation and to the obligation of all the tent. But they shall not come near to the furnishings of the sanctuary and to the altar, lest both they and you die. And they shall be joined with you and attend to the obligations of the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent. But an outsider may not come near you." The point of this seems to be to reestablish the lines. There are the priests and the Levites, and they have certain responsibilities. The priests are the ministers that do the sacrifices and the offerings. The Levites, they take care of the furnishings and they guard the place. So those lines, it seems to me, must have been blurred during the rebellion of Korah. And the last sentence, "And they shall be joined with you and attend to the obligations of the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, but an outsider may not come near you." An outsider meaning a non-Levite may not come near you. My suspicion is that during the Korah rebellion, people did. The people infringed upon that territory, people who were not Levites. There's another indication, I think, of that later on. Verse 5. "So you shall attend to the obligations of the sanctuary and the obligations of the altar, that there may no longer be wrath upon the sons of Israel. And behold, I myself have taken your fellow Levites from among the sons of Israel. They are a gift to you, dedicated to the Lord, to perform the service for the tent of meeting. But you and your sons with you shall attend to your priesthood for everything concerning the altar and inside the veil, and you are to perform service. I am giving you the priesthood as a bestowed service, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. So this is reestablishing the role of the priesthood. The Levites are to serve the priesthood. They are subservient to the priesthood, but serve it inside the temple. And it is the priests that are to offer the sacrifices and the offerings. And then we end with that same phrase, that same idea, but the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. No outsiders, no one besides the priests and Levites in the tabernacle. Verse 8. Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, "Now behold, I myself have given you charge of my offerings, even all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel. I have given them to you as a portion, and to your sons as a perpetual allotment. This shall be yours from the most holy gifts reserved from the fire, every offering of theirs, even every grain offering, and every sin offering, and every guilt offering which they shall render to me, shall be most holy for you and for your sons. As the most holy gifts you shall eat it, every male shall eat it, it shall be holy to you. This also is yours, the offering of their gift, even all the wave offerings of the sons of Israel. I have given them to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual allotment. Every one of your household who is clean may eat it, all the best of the fresh oil and all the best of the fresh wine and of the grain, the first fruits of those which they give to the Lord, I will give them to you. The first ripe fruits of all that is in the land, in their land, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours. Every one of your household who is clean may eat it. Every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours. Every first issue of the womb of all flesh, whether man or animal, which they offer to the Lord, shall be yours. Nevertheless, the firstborn of the man you shall surely redeem. And the firstborn of unclean animals you shall redeem. And as to their redemption price, from a month old you shall redeem them by your valuation, 5 shekels in silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, which is 20 gerahs. But the firstborn of an ox, or the firstborn of a sheep, or the firstborn of a goat, you shall not redeem. They are holy. You shall sprinkle their blood on the altar, and you shall offer up their fat in smoke as an offering by fire, for a soothing aroma to the Lord. And their meat shall be yours. It shall be yours like the breast of a wave offering and like the right thigh. All the offerings of the holy gifts which the son of Israel offered to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and your daughters with you as a perpetual allotment. It is an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord to you and to your descendants with you. Then the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, nor own any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the sons of Israel. So this is going through describing what will be the provision for the priesthood. How are they going to make a living? How are they going to survive? What is their portion? And it goes through and it lists the various things that will be their portion. Some of it, the offerings and the sacrifices are for just the priests and their sons, not the rest of their family. But then, the wave offerings are to be given to the sons and the daughters, as well as the offering of the first fruits. Now, as you'll recall, every Israelite was required every year to offer the first fruits to God. So it would be some of the first of their harvest that would go to God, and every first animal born goes to God. So those things would be taken to the temple, and then those go to the priest and the priest's family and everybody in their household. And it's supposed to be the best. The Israelites are supposed to give the best of their produce. Then it talks about which animals can be redeemed and which ones cannot be redeemed. If you'll recall, there was early in Numbers, there was the census taken, and every firstborn child had to be redeemed. Every firstborn male had to be redeemed. And by redeemed, an amount had to be paid for that child. And it was this, I think it was the same amount, the 5 shekels. So every firstborn child, male, boy, has to be redeemed, but also their animals, they have the option of redeeming the firstborn of their animals, except the ox, the sheep, and the goat. They cannot be redeemed. Those have to be given over to God. And all of that also is then to be eaten by the priest and the priest's family. And it says, this is an everlasting covenant of salt. Nobody knows exactly what that means. An everlasting covenant of salt, it's only used one other time in a similar kind of context. But presumably it's talking about a covenant that is kind of redundant. An everlasting covenant of salt. The salt is indicating that which is eternal. So that is the provision that God has made for the priests. The priests then will get no land when they go into the promised land. Every other tribe is going to get an allotment of land, and that land will be divided up among all the people in that tribe. And they will get a piece of land, and that land will be theirs in perpetuity. It will belong to that family. And that's what's called their inheritance. That's their land that will stay with them. The priests, however, will get no land. Their provision is all going to come through offerings and sacrifices that are given by the people. Verse 21. And to the sons of Levi, behold, I have given all the tithe in Israel for an inheritance, in return for their service which they perform, the service of the tent of meeting. And the sons of Israel shall not come near the tent of meeting again, lest they bear sin and die. Only the Levites shall perform the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations and among the sons of Israel. They shall have no inheritance. For the tithe of the sons of Israel, which they offer as an offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites for an inheritance. Therefore I have said concerning them, they shall have no inheritance among the sons of Israel. So the Levites also have no inheritance. They will not get a piece of land. They will get the tithe. So every Israelite, in addition to all the other offerings and sacrifices, they are supposed to give 1/10 of what they produce to God, give it to the temple. And that will then be distributed to the Levites. So that's the provision for them. Notice verse 22. And the sons of Israel shall not come near the tent of meeting again, lest they bear sin and die. They aren't supposed to come again, suggesting that they came before. And I think that's a hint that during the Korah's ascendancy, that non-Levites were encouraged to come into the temple. But now the Levites are supposed, they have the job of making sure that no one infringes on that. Okay. Verse 25. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Moreover, you shall speak to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the sons of Israel the tithe which I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall present an offering from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe. And your offering shall be reckoned to you as the grain from the threshing floor or the full produce from the vine, from the wine vat. So you shall also present an offering to the Lord from your tithes, which you receive from the sons of Israel. And from it you shall give the Lord's offering to Aaron the priest. Out of all your gifts you shall present every offering due to the Lord, from all the best of them, the sacred part from them. And you shall say to them, when you have offered from it the best of it, then the rest shall be reckoned to the Levites as the product of the threshing floor and as the product of the wine vat. And you may eat it anywhere, you and your households, for it is your compensation in return for your service in the tent of meeting. And you shall bear no sin by reason of it, when you have offered the best of it. But you shall not profane the sacred gifts of the sons of Israel, lest you die." So the Levites get one-tenth of, they get the tithe that's brought in by all the Israelites. Then they will take from that tithe that's their portion, they give one-tenth and give it over to the priests. And it's the best part. They're supposed to give the best part of the tithe that they have received. So it's a tithe of a tithe. Next chapter then is changing topics significantly. It's going to talk about the red heifer. Verse 1 in chapter 19. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "This is the statute of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, speak to the sons of Israel that they may bring you an unblemished red heifer, in which is no defect and on which a yoke has never been placed. And you shall give it to Eleazar the priest, and it shall be brought outside the camp and be slaughtered in his presence. Next, Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of the blood towards the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. Then the heifer shall be burned in his sight, its hide and its flesh and its blood with its refuse shall be burned. And the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet material and cast it into the midst of the burning heifer. The priest shall then wash his clothes and bathe his body in water and afterward come into the camp. But the priest shall be unclean until evening. The one who burns it shall also wash his clothes in water and bathe his body in water and shall be unclean until evening. Now a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them outside the camp in a clean place. And the congregation of the sons of Israel shall keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. And the one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. And it shall be a perpetual statute to the sons of Israel and to the alien who sojourns among them." So they are instructed to take a red heifer, and it has to be completely red. No white, no other color on it, without blemish. And it is to be taken outside of the camp, and it is to be burned. Eleazar is the one who is instructed to do that. I don't know why Eleazar is opposed to Aaron, but that's what was instructed. Eleazar kills the heifer, takes some of the blood, and sprinkles it toward the door of the tabernacle. Well, the tabernacle would have been inside the camp, so he's sprinkling it in that direction. He does that 7 times, and then the heifer is all burned. Every bit of it, the hide, its flesh, its blood, its refuse, all of it is burned, and into the fire are thrown cedar wood, hyssop, and scarlet material. And I'm sure that's all highly symbolic, but I don't know what it's symbolic of. So that is all burned up. And when it's all burned up, then the priest is unclean. So the priest goes and washes his clothes, bathes his body in water, and afterward he can go back into the camp, but he is unclean until evening. And the one who burns it is also unclean and has to go through the same process where he washes his clothes and bathes, and he is unclean until evening. And then there's a third person who then gathers up all the ashes when it's all burned and puts them presumably in a container that's put outside the camp in a clean place, it says. And those ashes then are kept there. And what they will do with those ashes is they will mix those with water, and those ashes will be used as a way of purifying things. It will be kept, they will keep it as water to remove impurity. It is purification from sin. That person who does the gathering also goes through this process of washing his clothes, washing himself, and he's unclean until evening. The one who touches the corpse of any person shall be unclean for 7 days. That one shall purify himself from uncleanness with the water on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and then he shall be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, he shall not be clean. Anyone who touches a corpse, the body of a man who has died, and does not purify himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel. Because the water for impurity was not sprinkled on him, he shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. So anyone who touches a corpse becomes unclean and needs to be cleansed using the ashes from the red heifer. Ashes mixed with water. And he is to be, he will be unclean for 7 days. He has to be washed on the 3rd day and the 7th day, and then he will be clean again. Now, presumably, this chapter about the red heifer and cleansing, being cleansed from uncleanness that you get from touching a corpse, it makes sense that this would be here, given that 17,000 corpses, 14,000 corpses are in their midst that they have to deal with. So that could be part of the reason that this is included here. It goes on in verse 14. This is the law when a man dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. And every open vessel which has no covering tied down on it shall be unclean. Also, anyone who in the open field touches one who has been slain with a sword, or who has died naturally, or a human bone or a grave shall be unclean for 7 days. Then for the unclean person, they shall take some of the ashes of the burnt purification from sin, and flowing water shall be added to them in a vessel. And a clean person shall take hyssop and dip it in the water and sprinkle it on the tent and on the furnishings and on the persons who were there and on the one who touched the bone or the one slain or the one dying naturally or the grave. Then the clean person shall sprinkle on the unclean on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and on the 7th day he shall purify him from uncleanness, and he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water, and he shall be clean by evening. So if somebody dies in a tent, then the whole tent is and everyone in it is unclean. Any containers? What's it say? Any containers that are left open? So all of that needs to be cleaned with the ashes and the water. So it's ashes from the burnt heifer mixed with flowing water. In Israel, they call it living water. There are certain kinds of water that are considered to be living water. And it's water that's flowing, or rain that comes down is also considered living water. But stagnant pools are not living water. And I can't remember all the other distinctions. But so this has to be living water then that's mixed with the ashes. And they have to go through this process of being cleansed on the third day and the seventh day before they become unclean, before they become clean. The last section. But the man who is unclean and does not purify himself from uncleanness, that person shall be cut off from the midst of the assembly, because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water for impurity has not been sprinkled on him. He is unclean. So it shall be a perpetual statute for them. And he who sprinkles the water for impurity shall wash his clothes, and he who touches the water for impurity shall be unclean until evening. Furthermore, anything that the unclean person touches shall be unclean, and the person who touches it shall be unclean until evening. So this is required of anyone. If they don't follow this, they will be cut off from the midst of the assembly. Everyone who touches the corpse needs to be cleansed, as well as those who are involved in washing, cleansing the person who has touched a corpse. Okay. I have a few comments, and then I'm going to summarize what I think is going on in these last four chapters. It is interesting to me that God's provision for the Levites and the priests is through the offerings that are given by the people of Israel. But there was no system set up whereby those were gathered by some kind of central agency. It was each individual was obligated to give this, and it was between him and God whether he was doing what he was required to do. If people gave their tithes and offered their first fruits as they were required by the law to do, then the priests and Levites would have plenty to eat. But if they didn't, then the priests and Levites had little to eat. And there were times in the history of Israel where that was the case. Which means that the welfare of the priests and the Levites became a barometer of the spiritual well-being of the nation, which I think is very interesting. With respect to the red heifer, there's a lot of talk about the red heifer. Some of you have probably read about this. There are no red heifers that qualify by the law to make the sacrifice and create the ashes that are necessary for cleansing. There are a few, I don't know how many, there are a few farms where people are diligently working to produce a red heifer that qualifies. Every once in a while you'll hear in periodicals that I read, you'll hear that they think they've got it, and I haven't heard if any of those have been authorized, that rabbis would have to go and inspect and decide whether it qualifies or not. But they are working on it very hard, and they are at least getting close. The reason that this is important is because traditionally, when the temple is built, it has to be consecrated and dedicated, and ashes from the red heifer have to be used to clean the temple. So before a third temple can be built, There has to be a red heifer that can be offered as a sacrifice, and the ashes of that red heifer then used to cleanse the temple. So that's a big deal. If there's a place in the old city that's run by the Temple Institute. I don't know if any of you have been there. It's an interesting place, but they are working on researching and doing various things to lay the groundwork for a third temple to be built. And there are rumors about all kinds of things that they're doing. I don't know how many of those rumors are true, but clearly there are some things that they are doing to further that effort. And they are very involved and watching with respect to the red heifer to see when, if and when that will be developed. What was so significant about the staff? Why did God set up that particular test to show the legitimacy of Aaron's power? If I'm understanding what happened correctly, one of the things that Korah must have been saying is that Moses and Aaron cannot be trusted. So if they say, God says we're in charge, that doesn't count for anything. So what is set up here is a test that's going to show that Aaron is the one who is put in charge and everybody can see it. It is clear to everyone. There's no mediator involved in this. They can see the staff. And this one is more significant than the earth-eating Korah and his followers, and more significant than the plague stopping when Aaron takes the censer and stands between those who had died and those who were still living. Both of those were quite remarkable, but the earth does sometimes open up. There are sinkholes. There are things that happen like that. And when Aaron, using the censer, stood between the living and the dead and the plague stopped, well, plagues do sometimes stop, fortunately. So both of those are very unusual, but they are not impossible. The stick shooting forth buds and leaves and fruit overnight, that doesn't happen. This is truly amazing. There's no question but what this is God's doing. I suspect it also is of significance that this produced almonds. Throughout their journey through the wilderness, the issue has been food. Where are we going to get food? We haven't got enough of it. We haven't got the right kind, etc., etc. Well, here, God is showing he can bring food out of that which is dead. He can produce food anywhere, and that has to get their attention. It is also significant that we're taking a dead stick and life comes from it. That God is the one who controls life and death. And as it turns out, we have no more recorded challenges to Aaron's authority. So when God said this will lessen the grumbling, well, with respect to Aaron's authority, that ends. We are going to have another incident in the next chapter where there is grumbling. So it didn't stop the grumbling completely, but it did stop the grumbling with respect to Aaron's authority. Now, I'm going to try to go through these four chapters, just talk about what I think is going on here. There are, I admittedly, there are just some little clues that I am trying to put together into a coherent whole, and it's not very clear what's going on, so I'm filling in, and it's your job to figure out whether I have filled in responsibly or not, whether it's a good way of filling in the holes. But I think what has happened, I think Korah's rebellion was Korah was saying, we are all holy. God said we are a holy nation. So that means we are all holy. And if we are all holy, then we all have direct access to God. This stuff that's been set up where you're screened off from the temple, the tabernacle, and that sort of thing, that is all Moses and Aaron power grabbing. That is them setting up their little procedures that keep you distanced from God. And that is not the way that it should be. So I suspect Korah actually encouraged the laity to come into the tabernacle. That's what I'm guessing. And largely based on the clues that I showed you in the law, because three times in chapter 18, it talks about no one, no stranger, no non-Levite coming into the tabernacle. So I suspect Korah encouraged that, and it would make sense given his perspective that they are all holy. So as a result, the Korah rebellion is kind of breaking down. What does it mean to be a priest? What does it mean to be a Levite? It's breaking down those boundaries, and it's making it like, no, we're all holy. We can all do all of that stuff. We can all have access to God. So what happens in chapters 16 and 17 is God enters into this to show, no, I have established a priesthood, and it's that priesthood that will have access to me. It's that priesthood that will intervene on your behalf when you need my action on your behalf. That priesthood will do that. And the Levites, they will have an important position in the tabernacle. They will support the priests, but they are not priests. There are things within the tabernacle that they will not be doing. Only the priests will be doing those things. So God is coming in to show that that's the case, and that's the way things will be. And as a result, God wipes out Korah, Abiram, and Dathan. They're all swallowed up by the earth. And the 250 prominent men from Israel that were their supporters, who had the incense burners, the fire comes out and it consumes all of them. So God's making a really clear statement. It's not them. They should not be doing what they're doing. They are not the ones that come before me as to intercede on your behalf. And then we have the people. The next day, the people are saying, you killed the Lord's, the Lord's people? Yeah, the Lord's people. You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people. That's what they're saying to Moses and Aaron. Well, the earth opened up and swallowed them. The fire came out of the temple. But they're blaming that somehow on Moses and Aaron. So they're still looking at things as though Korah and his followers were in the right. So whatever Korah was preaching, it was powerful. It was something that a lot of people bought into. So God sends the plague, and 14,000 people are killed by the plague. And at the end of that, then after that plague, Then God sets up this demonstration with the staffs. That one is done without any rebellion to initiate it. The first two, there was a rebellion to initiate what God did. This time it's at God's initiative. I'm going to set up this test. I'm going to show you. I'm going to give a demonstration of the fact that Aaron is the priest. And so that demonstration is given. And at that point, the people's response is, we're all going to die. So I think what they're saying there is what Korah had been teaching, it was not true. And if it's not true, how do we get access to God? If that's the way it is, we are all kept away from God, and we're gonna die. So chapter 18 then is laws that reestablish the boundaries. There are priests, and they do the sacrifices and the offerings, and they are the people that represent you before God. There are the Levites that help the priests, and you need to present your offerings and your tithes in order for them to be provided for. Now, the red heifer, I'm not sure exactly why it fits in here. It makes sense that we've got a lot of corpses to deal with, and so we need a means by which those people can be made clean. But I suspect that there is a more full explanation for why this chapter is here. I just haven't figured out what that is yet. Okay, questions, comments?
These are just observations. The first is, I think it's you that's told me in the past, isn't it interesting that God gave Adam and Eve a garden, and then what man wanted was a city, and that eventually God will give us a city. And so the observation being, oh, that's interesting. What the people wanted was direct access, and eventually we're given that.
Yeah, very true.
Other observation is, I grew up in the land of almond orchards, and not only would it be super freaky to have an almond stick come to life or a stick of any kind, but it takes a long time for those almonds to become ripe. There's no way you would ever, ever, ever see a tree that had buds and leaves and ripe almonds on it. Just wouldn't happen.
Yeah. I was thinking about this a little bit. As a farmer, there are things that you can do to encourage your plants to grow, but ultimately, you can't do it. You can't make them do it. That is a natural process that you are dependent on, but you can't make it happen. And that would certainly be true here. And they would all have understood that.
When you start talking about a red heifer, I don't have any problem with that. I mean, if you take ranchers out and you have a field of livestock and you start talking about the red heifers, or there's no problem. But the red that we're talking about is not the red of the flag there. And so it's interesting what we mean by red, what exactly is that? But that wasn't my real question. We've talked about this before, and that's where you have people that are considered more holy, more upfront with God than others. And we run into this in this particular case again, where the high priests are in a position where, seemingly anyway, they're in a more holy position than the regular people. And last time we talked about it, it was that they're more holy not because of the condition of their heart, but because of the position that they were holding. So, I mean, you might just comment on that. I don't know if I have that exactly right as far as what we were thinking before, but my main question is, well, how does that relate then to where we're at now? I mean, what was that trying to show us that was coming down the road or whatever? Because we now don't really talk about people in position of being more holy than others. We're talking about conditions of the heart. So right. Anyway, that's what I was.
Right. Yeah. The way I'm looking at this right now is what God set up. I'm going to use the wrong word here, but it's there's a sense in which it's kind of a game that, or a play, or a it's a set of pictures or images for us to understand what holiness is like, but it's all by analogy. So holiness is a separateness, a set apartness for the service of God. And that's what the word means. And so what happens in the Old Testament is we have all these rules and stuff that convey that sense that they are set apart. They're completely different. Later on, I think that what we're to understand is that becomes true of the saints. They are completely separate, set apart. It's something that you could touch and feel back then that help you to understand what that set apartness is, what it's like. So I think that's what's going on in the whole temple. And everything that was done there is just setting up pictures that can then be used to help understand the principles then that become part of the way God has constructed the salvific history of the world and what happens with those who embrace God. Now there was something else I was going to say. Oh, so what's interesting about this, and I haven't put it all together. I'm still working on it. It's a complicated process to put all this stuff together. It seems, at least for me it is, that the priesthood, Aaron, being the one who has to be the one who goes before God on our behalf, that becomes a wonderful picture of what Jesus does. So it becomes a picture that's used for that purpose rather than to say that there are built-in hierarchies within society and whatever, wherever else you might want to go with it. That was just what was set up back then to create a picture that could be used to help us understand something that's really significant in our salvation and our lives as believers. But it's not setting up some kind of order that in human society that should always be. Does that help at all?
What do you think that Korah thought he would achieve if he didn't have to go through Moses to get it?
I think Korah is using, as I mentioned last week, Korah is using a time-tested method of gaining power. If he says everybody's holy, I mean, that's an easy sell. I mean, who's going to balk at that? So everybody's holy. And if we're all holy, then power shouldn't be consolidated. It shouldn't be all in the hands of Moses and Aaron. And by making that argument, he destabilizes the power of Moses and Aaron, which allows him then to step in to that destabilized situation and lay claim to more power.
And what is that power?
Well, I think I'm not sure what the nature of that power would be, whether it's just kind of moral authority or I suspect maybe control over the temple, the tabernacle and what's going on there, be in a position to hand out favors in various ways.
So he's basically trying to run for mayor. He doesn't necessarily want to be.
I think so. And what better way to get votes than to say everybody's holy and should have access to the temple, tabernacle?
I could hear him saying, instead of Moses telling us which way to go after we break camp, we'll sit down and have a vote. And since I'm Korah, you'll probably want to be in my quote-unquote camp. And I'll choose which way we go. I don't think it was access to God. I mean, you would agree that access to God without an intermediary was not his goal.
It was,
he wanted to be a warlord, a tribal chieftain.
Right. I think what was really driving him was a desire for power and the people around him. That's really what was driving it.
So there was no, I mean, at first I sort of kind of heard you this time saying that maybe Korah wanted to do the right thing a different way, but I think we agree that from the get-go he had no interest in doing the right thing. Being a child of God was the least of his concerns.
Yeah. I think that it's possible for someone to be self-deceived, such that if you were to ask him, he'd say, "No, I'm truly interested in what's good and true and following that, and be rather compelling in doing that." But I really think that if you were to examine more deeply, yes, he was just power hungry.
And so I'm trying to figure out from what little I read of ancient history where he got the model for that, because it certainly wasn't in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
And
democracy is not commonplace in the ancient world.
And the thing you said about how God is putting us in this this role-playing game, which is kind of what it is, but it's got some pretty clear parameters and pathways, and it's like, if you do this right, you'll figure it out. I mean, eventually you'll get to the right place. There are a lot of their analogies come from Egyptian religion. I mean, the model for the ark is on the walls, judgment is carved into the walls, the frescoes and their temples and tombs. You mentioned that the tabernacle itself was sort of a ersatz, Pharaoh's roving palace, temple tent. I mean, there's a lot of their imagery that seems to come from, that is allowed to come from Egyptian culture.
And Mesopotamia more broadly. I mean, ancient Near East. Mm-hmm.
So, but the idea of a God who is the one true God that has no need of the earth to manifest himself, that does not need worship to remain living and strong, who really is not in conflict with a bunch of other gods and needs their help to, as above, so below, to work out its way. That's unique, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. The way I see it is the ancient Near East had created a cultural vocabulary. And like any cultural vocabulary, you can say a lot of different things with it. And what God does is he draws upon that existing vocabulary and he puts things together in such a way that he says something that is absolutely new, that's extremely profound and new. And so something that the other cultures have not said with that, but he's just using that as his language to communicate his message.
Just occurred to me as you said that, the Egyptian god of the dead, compare their rituals to the forbidden touching the dead, being around the dead, servicing the dead in Hebrew culture is a whole nother thing. It actually is symbolic of death itself, and therefore it is unclean. You couldn't participate in temple rite. You couldn't serve in the temple rite, sometimes for 7 days, sometimes for till sundown. That in itself makes death itself a metaphor or a symbol of something new.
Yes.
Doesn't it? Yeah, it does.
Yep. That's the kind of thing I'm thinking of. Exactly.
Three quick questions. Verse 1 of chapter 18. Do you have any, you shall bear the guilt in connection with the sanctuary and bear the guilt in connection with your priesthood?
I think the idea is you will be responsible.
Okay.
You'll be responsible for what happens there.
Okay. So, and if you mess up, then it's on you.
Yep.
Is the penalty of death for someone other than the Levite, that's not new, right? Or is it? Is this made explicit here as the penalty in a way that it wasn't before?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I need to go look at that. I'm not positive.
But the point that you were making is that even if it was, they're going to say, yeah, but Aaron and Moses just made that up. That's just their way of protecting.
Yep.
And then finally, the red heifer. There's a lot of washing going on here. Mm-hmm. Does it all have to be water that's been...
Yes, in this, in purification from death, from touching that which is dead, I think the assumption is all of that has to be done with the ashes mixed with water.
Okay. Now, the other washings among the Jews, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. It depends on what kind of washing it is. But apparently, this cleansing from corruption with death, it has to be dealt with by the red heifer.
I also have a question about the using death as a punishment. So if the non-priests or Levites come too close into the sanctuary, then it says they will be put to death. So I understand that. And then in 32, the last verse of 18, he's saying, tell the Levites, if you don't give the best of the best in your tithe, then you might die. It says, by presenting the best part, then you will not defile the holy offerings of the Israelites, and you will not die. Is that the same? Is he talking about the same sort of death, where they would actually be put to death as a punishment if they didn't follow that rule, or is this a different thing going on?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. The thing that comes to my mind is the sons of Eli. Do you remember that story? The sons of Eli were priests, and they were boiling meat and eating it, and they were doing something that was irregular, and they both, God killed them both. So it's that kind of thing, whether God is expecting the death penalty to be imposed on them by the priests and Levites, or whether that's something that God is going to do, I'm not sure. But it's profaning the gifts, that is, abusing them in some way, not doing what you're supposed to be doing with them. The penalty for that is death.
I wasn't here last week, so I didn't hear what you had to say, but the question of this whole, the rebellion and the reasons for it, and I'm looking in verse, chapter 16, when Korah and his people say, you've gone far enough, every one of us is holy, God is in our midst as well. And I had forgotten that this is sort of like on the heels of the the rebellion against God that is going to cause all of them to be laid low in the wilderness.
Right.
And it just, I don't know, I can't even imagine the feeling of despair that would be at hand for anyone 20 years and older to just recognize that here we are and here we are going to perish. Mm-hmm. And then to realize that that God wasn't speaking directly to the people. They were hearing all of this through Moses and God's judgments through Moses. So to what extent, and maybe you spoke to this already, maybe this, to what extent do you think Moses speaking and telling the people, hey, God's judging us and we're all going to, you know, none of you are going to enter, your children will enter. And it seems like a just an obvious thing that would happen to have people want to take up some kind of...
Right.
Is there a connection there? Did you speak to that? Is that it?
I think that's exactly it. Most of the explanation... There are some things that everybody can see. They can see the cloud that's in front of them. They can see the pillar at night. They can see the manna on the ground in the mornings. They saw the Red Sea open. They heard God speak to them at Mount Sinai. So there are some things that everybody knows directly, and that's why they're all Yahwehs. Nobody's suggesting we should worship another God. They're all Yahwehs. The question is, what does Yahweh stand for, and how has he set things up? And most of that kind of information is coming through Moses. God speaks to Moses, and he proclaims that to the people. And I think what Korah has done is he has decided there's the place where we need to attack this thing, that they are misrepresenting things. They are representing things to their benefit. And it could be that they're saying that Moses and Aaron are not adequately or accurately giving our side to God. I'm not sure exactly how they're thinking about that, but something along those lines. In any case, that Moses and Aaron are power grabbing. That's what Korah is suggesting. And therefore, you need to give power to me.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.